welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers read out their articles from the latest issue. First up this week, we'll have Katie Balls, the Spectator's deputy political editor, about how the government's COVID optimism is fading fast. Then we'll be hearing from Douglas Murray, the Spectator's associate editor, about how the 2020s will be boring, not roaring. And finally, Nigel Farndale sheds light on the uncomfortable truth about Nazis and the Olympics. First up, it's Katie Balls.
When the news broke on Sunday morning that Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak planned to skip self-isolation, availing themselves of a loophole, the reaction was as much disbelief as fury. Could the Prime Minister and Chancellor, even for a second, think it right to excuse themselves from the test and trace regime that they have imposed on millions? They changed their minds after just a few hours, but it raised wider concerns in the party. What on earth are they thinking? And is this typical of the quality of decision-making we can expect ahead of a tricky few weeks? Of course, they both had other plans in mind for so-called Freedom Day. By this point in the roadmap, the hope was that the virus would be in retreat and the UK heading towards a great British summer. Ministers were counting down to their holidays, while Johnson had spent the past few weeks focused on returning to his post-COVID domestic agenda, with an underwhelming levelling up speech, along with plans for his social care announcement to mark his 2-year anniversary as Prime Minister. Now that has been delayed, likely until autumn. Perhaps later. The COVID crisis has not gone away. A lot of people in government are bored of the pandemic now, but we don't have a choice, says one minister. Neither were the 4.5 million people forecast to be pinged between now and 16 August, when the double jabbed will be exempt from self-isolation. It adds up to a summer of political dysfunction. There is unease in Westminster about the next few months and whether Johnson's team is up to the task. Number 10 aides find themselves between a rock and a hard place. Facing flak from scientists and Labour for easing too many rules, and from their own side for not relaxing them enough, especially the self-isolation guidance. Government departments are split on which is a bigger threat, the virus or the pingdemic. Business Minister Paul Scully suggested in an interview that the test and trace app was advisory. Number 10 hit back, saying that it is crucial people self-isolate when asked. The situation is bonkers, complains a Tory MP. But with so many restrictions lifted, Number 10 is reluctant to relax self-isolation guidance. It is now viewed as the last line of defence. The initial optimistic language of an irreversible roadmap has been traded for promises of further action if needed. There is already talk of restrictions returning by the autumn if cases outpace government modelling and hospitalisations climb to a higher level than anticipated. The problem is that there is a growing concern over how the current operation will handle choppy waters. The self-isolation fiasco sent alarm bells ringing, says a member of government. The Prime Minister isn't listening to anyone, claims an official. After a series of departures from Downing Street, there is concern that his current Chief of Staff, Dan Rosenfield, lacks the political news to guide the Prime Minister and is walking into trap after trap. The decision to allow UEFA officials and foreign VIPs to skip quarantine to attend the Euros being another. Suddenly, announcing a new vaccine-only passport system for nightclubs from September has gone down like a cup of cold sick with backbenchers. As the MP for Workington, Mark Jenkinson, put it in a WhatsApp message to his colleagues, what fresh hell is this? They managed to unite clubbers and Tory MPs around a common cause, says one government figure. The government versus the young just in time for summer. What could possibly go wrong? My colleagues had very high expectations of what Freedom Day would look like, says one member of government. Everyone has gradually been enraged by the many restrictions. For Johnson, the end of the roadmap has brought with it more political problems than solutions. His new look number 10 is about to face its toughest test yet.
That was Katie Balls, and now Douglas Murray.
Get Ready for the Boring 20s by Douglas Murray. Earlier this year, I noted the suggestion, made by an American academic and run with by a swathe of the British media, that we may be about to enter a party decade. The claim was that, much as the Great War was followed by the roaring 1920s, so the COVID era might be followed by a roaring 2020s. Advocates of the theory might point to the queues of young people waiting to get into the country's nightclubs at 1 minute past midnight on Monday's so-called Freedom Day. But I would suggest that there is more evidence accumulating in the opposite direction. Far from roaring, I would say it is more likely that we are entering the era of the boring 20s. Much has already been said about how underwhelming Freedom Day was, not least because our twice-jabbed Prime Minister gave his great national address from self-isolation. Adding to the feeling of merriment, he then warned that from September, anyone over the age of 18 hoping to go into a nightclub or other venue where large crowds gather will have to show papers demonstrating that they are fully vaccinated. Meanwhile, the NHS Ping app has already closed musicals and other live performances that were finally about to return. The future rolling out before us is one not of greater freedom, but of endless pings, masks, boosters, and variants. And yet, it is the response of wider society, and not just officialdom, which suggests a problem. Small yet suggestive case studies have hinted that we are keener to put the dampeners on than we are to take them off. Take the response to the antics of Charlie Perry, who made national headlines after celebrating England's Euros final in traditional fashion. The 25-year-old roofer had, by his own estimation, drunk around 20 cans of cider since 8:30 that morning, and later got into Wembley Stadium without paying. On such a day, how could his celebrations not have been limitless? These culminated in Leicester Square, where Perry pulled his pants down around his ankles, stuck a flare up his bottom, and lit it. The resulting display was clearly intended in a spirit of generosity. As Perry himself said, after 18 months of misery, he fancied that people might want a bit of cheering up. And while this may not be how you or I might try to brighten the mood, it struck Mr. Perry as just the ticket. Thanks to all the cider, he claims not to have felt any pain from the sparks, but he does admit that it was a very irresponsible thing to do. He doesn't know the half of it. Some years back, a young squaddy in Sunderland decided to vim up his local Guy Fawkes Night by bending over, sticking a rocket up his backside and lighting the blue touch paper. For reasons we need not linger over, the rocket failed to achieve liftoff, stuck where it was, and performed its full display while doggedly lodged in the squaddy's rectum. I recall the incident, firstly, because the squaddy was taken to hospital with a scorched colon, a phrase it is hard to forget. And secondly, because the firework company felt obliged to release a statement reminding customers that the anus is not a recommended launch site for their product. The point is that Mr. Perry's antics may have been uncouth, unwise even, but they were not that unusual. This is roughly how England fans are expected to behave. What was surprising was the near universal opprobrium. While the crowds in Leicester Square mightily enjoyed the display, the reaction elsewhere was entirely disapproving. Across the media, the condemnations were unanimous. Doesn't he know how dangerous that is? What message does it give out about our nation? That sort of thing. And Perry is not the only person to have attracted such opprobrium. Many of the clubbers and partygoers who have tried to get their lives back this week have received a similar ticking off. An unmistakable sniffiness is in the air, with generally well-off older people whose own lives are relatively sorted tut-tutting away at younger people wanting to go out and enjoy themselves. How irresponsible, how selfish, appears to be the general reaction. Why can't they stay at home for another 2 years? It is not just the Puritanism, but the lack of empathy that alarms me. Many of these young clubbers are people who have spent the last 18 months almost completely on their own. They have studied alone, paid tuition fees to do online courses alone, have graduated alone, and are now heading into unemployment alone. All for a virus that will affect almost none of them. And it seems to me that in such a situation, a certain amount of tolerance and understanding should be extended towards them by older people. Last year, near the start of this pandemic, when everyone was talking about how it might change us, some optimistic types said it might bring us together. Mikael Welbeck is not an optimistic type. In fact, he is the pessimist's pessimist. But it seems to me that the French novelist's reaction was among the more accurate. Asked what society might look like after the virus, he said he thought it was likely to be the same, but worse. So far, everything is bearing out his analysis. Legislation that was supposed to be temporary has rolled on and on. Restrictions meant to be limited look as if they are going to be with us for the duration. People who like government interference in their lives might be happy. People fond of mass surveillance and monitoring might be happy. People keen on a future in which government and private sector busybodies use the virus as the ultimate excuse not to do anything they don't want to do will be happy. And that's before we get on to the debt, inflation, and the growing inability to accrue capital that is again going to disproportionately affect the young. So, if these 20s can roar, then excellent. Good luck to them. But I don't fancy their chances.
That was Douglas Murray, and finally, Nigel Farndale.
Game changer. How Hitler's Favourite Filmmaker Helped to Invent the Modern Olympics by Nigel Farndale. It's an uncomfortable truth, but the Olympic Games in their modern form were pretty much invented by the Nazis. They came up with the idea of the torch relay, for example, the one that begins in Olympia and ends with the lighting of the cauldron at the opening ceremony. But it wasn't the events at the 1936 Olympics that were new, so much as the way they were presented and filmed. Even today, the style of coverage owes much to Leni Riefenstahl, Hitler's favourite filmmaker and arguably the most gifted and influential female film director of the 20th century. Her groundbreaking techniques, as seen in her cinematic masterpiece Olympia, included low camera angles, smash cuts, extreme close-ups and tracking shots in a trench she had arranged to be dug alongside the long jump pit. She also attached automatic cameras to balloons to get aerial shots for the first time. Her greatest innovation was the use of waterproof cameras that worked in the swimming pool. They followed divers through the air, and as soon as they hit the water, the cameraman dived down with them, all the while changing aperture and focus. Riefenstahl, who had been a film star before turning to directing, was more interested in artistic expression than sporting competition, and this culminated in her hypnotic high-diving montage. So subtle and abstract was Olympia in this section that cinema audiences didn't realise they were at one point watching a diver emerging from the water, flying backwards through the air and then returning to the board. To say that Riefenstahl was a controversial figure is to understate. By the time she was commissioned to make her film about the Berlin Olympics, she had already made her name as the director of Triumph of the Will, the award-winning film of the 1934 Nuremberg Rally. Although she was never a member of the Nazi Party, an investigation by the Allies at the end of the war concluded that she was a fellow traveller only, her earlier films had nevertheless proved to be a powerful propaganda tool for Hitler. Having watched her films and read the various biographies of her while researching my new novel, The Dictator's Muse, in which she features, I went to visit the Olympic Stadium in Berlin. The authorities had considered knocking it down in 1998, but instead decided that the building could be repurposed as a football stadium. The re-inauguration came in 2004. While the rest of the German capital lay in ruins, this magnificent piece of architecture, built in the style of a sunken amphitheatre, remained intact. In fact, the only part damaged in the war was the bell tower. As you follow the curving, pillared exterior of the stadium, hewn from Franconian limestone that almost glows in the light, you come to the giant bell that later fell to the ground and never rang again. It is rusty now and cracked, but the giant eagle motif on its side is still visible. The authorities welded over part of the small Nazi symbol at its bottom edge, it being illegal in Germany to display a swastika. Just as tour guides are banned by law from pointing out things with their arms extended stiffly, in case this could be misconstrued as a Hitler salute. It's easily done, as the French Olympic team discovered in 1936. When they paraded around the stadium in their blazers and berets for the opening ceremony, they gave the traditional Olympic salute, with arms raised to the side, but to the commentators it looked like a Nazi salute. To the German crowd too, which greeted the gesture with a roar of approval. The British team came next and did an eyes right instead, without raising their arms. This was met with a significant silence. Continuing around the outside of the stadium, you come to a large gap in its west end, the Marathon Gate, and here the hairs on the back of your neck rise as you read the names of some of the 1936 gold medal winners carved in stone. Among them are 100 metres, Loaf, Owens, USA, 200 metres, Loaf, Owens, USA, Weissprung, Owens, USA. Though the words are in German make them seem more poignant. Joseph Goebbels, Germany's propaganda minister, ordered Riefenstahl to edit the black athletes out of her film, but she refused. In fact, her representation of the great Jesse Owens is entirely positive, and he is repeatedly described by the commentator in the film as the fastest man in the world. Owens is shown not just winning his four gold medals, the fourth was for the 100-metre relay, but grinning endearingly down the lens of the camera afterwards. If Hitler was depicted as a Wagnerian deity in Triumph of the Will, it is Owens who gets the heroic treatment in Olympia. It's hard to see how the sections of the film which focus on him so appreciatively could have served the Nazis' white supremacist cause. Because more than 250 miles of film was exposed in the making of Olympia, it took Riefenstahl 2 years to edit it. Then began a series of gala premieres in the capitals of Europe, including Vienna, Paris, Copenhagen, Helsinki and Oslo. At each there were banquets, welcoming speeches from ambassadors and bouquets of flowers. In Graz, hundreds of young girls in Styrian costume formed a guard of honour from Riefenstahl's hotel to the cinema. In Stockholm, members of the audience rose spontaneously to their feet and sang Deutschland über alles. In Brussels, the Belgian king attended and Riefenstahl curtsied in the manner she had been hastily taught by one of his equerries. And at the Venice Biennale, Olympia was awarded the Mussolini Cup, beating the bookies' favourite, Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. The plan was that this would all culminate in a screening in New York's Radio City, the biggest cinema in the world, followed by a triumphal cross-country American publicity tour. Riefenstahl was due to meet Louis B. Mayer, Charlie Chaplin and Clark Gable, as well as her old friend Marlene Dietrich. But it all went horribly wrong. Just after she arrived in New York in November 1938, news broke of Kristallnacht, in which more than 1,000 synagogues throughout the Reich were burnt and thousands of Jewish businesses vandalised. After Riefenstahl declared in the American press that she didn't believe these shocking reports, there were protests outside her hotel, led by Dorothy Parker. No studio boss in Hollywood would see her after that, with the exception being, of course, the somewhat right-wing Walt Disney. Having planned to stay in Hollywood and become an American citizen, Riefenstahl was instead obliged to return to Germany. In her unreliable memoirs, The Sieve of Memory, she gave her version of the extraordinary events she lived through in the 1930s. Some of her accounts are what today we would call alternative facts. While it is true, for example, that she was a libertine who kept what amounted to a harem of handsome actors, cameramen and athletes on call, she describes a Me Too moment in which an American athlete she was sleeping with during the Berlin Olympics stepped off the medal platform in front of the 100,000-strong crowd, ripped open her blouse and kissed her naked breasts. None of the journalists present reported this, which rather suggests that it didn't happen. Yet she was right about the Olympics being sexually charged, as Usain Bolt and the Swedish women's handball team would later attest. This was one of the reasons I wanted to set my novel about conflicting loyalties and a doomed love affair against the Berlin Olympics. It has since become a tradition, indeed, to supply free condoms to athletes in the Olympic Village. In Tokyo this year, 150,000 will be provided. Promiscuity among Olympic athletes may even have been another thing that the Nazis invented.
That was Nigel Farndale. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud. And remember, if you like this podcast or any of our other podcasts, please do leave us a review. We love hearing from you. Thanks for listening and join us again next week.